A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He recently figured out what a UPC actually is, and had that moment where you realize the little barcode you've ignored your whole life is actually a skeleton key. You can use it to cut through marketing copy and compare real specs instead of brand stories. But it's way more nuanced than just scanning a barcode. The question is, which identifier do you actually trust, and where do you take it once you have it?
The timing on this is perfect, or terrible, depending on how you look at it. We're now drowning in AI-generated product descriptions and SEO spam spec sheets. You search for the wattage of a vacuum cleaner, and the top 10 results are all affiliate blogs that scraped each other and got the number wrong 3 scrapes ago. Knowing which identifier points to a real engineering document, not a content farm's best guess, that's genuinely a superpower right now.
It's the difference between buying a product and buying the story someone wrote about it.
The thing most people don't realize, I didn't for years, is that the UPC is actually the least useful identifier for spec hunting. It's built for checkout, not for research. The real workhorses are part numbers, model numbers, and a whole taxonomy of codes that most consumers never learn exist.
This episode is the manual playbook. No API, no global product database. We accept that doesn't exist for regular people. But there's a workflow, and once you know it, you'll never read an Amazon spec table the same way again.
We're going to start with the UPC, where it came from, what it actually identifies, and why it's not what most people think it is. Then we'll map the whole family tree, EAN, GTIN, MPN, ASIN, SQA, what each one means and when to reach for it. Then the geographic mess, same product, different barcodes in different countries, and the practical spec hunting playbook for when you're standing in an aisle or staring at a product page trying to figure out which one actually has the better motor.
I love that this started with someone staring at a barcode and thinking, wait, what is this thing actually doing?
The origin story is great. 1973, the Uniform Code Council, which is now GS1US, developed the Universal Product Code. The first live scan happened in June 1974 at a Marsh supermarket in Troy, Ohio. A 10-pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit Gum. That pack of gum is now in the Smithsonian.
Of course it is. Americans put everything in a museum.
The pack, corn. Not the scanner. Though the scanner's probably in a warehouse somewhere, but here's what matters structurally. A UPC is 12 digits. The first 6 to 10 digits are the company prefix, assigned by GS1, and companies pay for it. An annual fee based on revenue. Small businesses pay about $750 a year. Global enterprises pay tens of thousands. The remaining digits are the item reference plus a check digit that verifies the scan was correct.
The company prefix is basically a rented namespace.
That's exactly what it is. And here's the first misconception that trips people up. A UPC does not identify a product. It identifies a specific package trade item at the point of sale. A 12-pack of Coke cans has a different UPC than a 6-pack, even though the cans inside are identical. Same liquid, same aluminum, different barcode, because it's a different sellable unit.
Which means if you're trying to compare the actual soda inside the can, the UPC is almost useless. It tells you about the packaging configuration, not the product.
And that gets us to the distinction that actually matters for spec hunting, part numbers versus model numbers versus UPCs. The part number, sometimes called the manufacturer, part number, or MPN, is assigned by the manufacturer for internal tracking. It's often the most granular identifier you can get, down to a specific revision or batch. The model number is the consumer-facing name, like WH-1000XM5, those Sony headphones everyone uses as an example. The UPC is just the retail checkout code.
One model number can have dozens of part numbers.
Take those Sony headphones. The model number is WH-1000XM5. The part number for the black US version is WH-1000XM5/B. The same model in Europe has a different part number. same/B suffix, but with EU regulatory additions, and a completely different barcode, an EAN instead of a UPC. The model number is the product family. The part number is the specific engineering artifact. The UPC is what the cashier scans.
The ASIN is what Amazon calls it.
B09Y2JY6S9 for that same pair of headphones. The ASIN, Amazon Standard Identification Number, is marketplace specific. It identifies the Amazon catalog entry, not the product itself. Different sellers listing the same headphones will all use that same ASIN, but the ASIN doesn't tell you anything about the engineering specs. It just tells you which Amazon page you're on.
We've got this granularity ladder. At the top, the model number, the product family. Below that, the part number, the specific revision, color, region. Below that, the UPC or EAN, the sellable unit at the shelf. And off to the side, the SKU and the ASI, which are retailer-specific inventory tags.
The GTIN is the umbrella that covers all of them. GTIN stands for Global Trade Item Number. A UPC is technically a GTIN 12. An EIN is a GTIN 13. Same family, different lengths. The only structural difference is that EANs have an extra leading digit, a country code prefix. 0 or 1 for the US and Canada, 4 for Japan, 5 for the UK, 8 for Italy. Everything else is the same system.
Which means when you scan a barcode in Tokyo versus Toledo, the database lookup might return different packaging, different regulatory labels, even different power cords, but the underlying product might be identical, or it might not be.
That's the geographic mess we'll get into. But first I want to nail down why the part number is the one you actually want. When an engineer is sourcing components, they don't search the UPC, they search the MPN. The MPN is what appears on datasheets, in distributor catalogs, on the manufacturer's support page. It's the identifier that says this exact thing, revision C, manufactured after June 2023. The UPC just says this box.
The playbook starts with ignore the barcode, find the MPN.
The barcode gets you through checkout. The MPN gets you through the spec sheet. And if you only remember one thing from this episode, that's the one.
Which raises the question. Where do you actually find the MPN? If you're standing in a store or looking at a product page that's been SEO-ed into oblivion.
The product box itself, it's usually printed near the barcode or on the regulatory label. The manufacturer's product page, not the retailer page, the actual manufacturer's site, or if you're looking at electronics, the FCCID label. But we'll get to the FCCID trick later. First, let's finish mapping this taxonomy, because there are a couple of identifiers we haven't named yet that matter in specific contexts.
SKU we touched on. But it's worth spelling out, SKU is entirely retailer-specific. Home Depot's SKU for a Dewalt drill is different from Lowe's SKU for the exact same drill. The SKU tells you where it is in the warehouse, not what it is.
That's why SKUs are dangerous for comparison shopping. You search a SKU on Google, and you'll only get results from that one retailer. Search the MPN, and you'll get results from everywhere, including distributor catalogs that have actual engineering data.
The hierarchy of trust, from most to least useful for spec hunting. MPN at the top, then model number, then GTIN or UPC, then ASIN, then SKU dead last.
I put SKU slightly above ASIN only because SKUs sometimes appear on manufacturer spec sheets as a cross-reference. But you're right about the basic shape. The closer you are to the manufacturer's internal tracking system, the better your data. The closer you are to the retailer's inventory system, the worse.
Let's get into the geographic question, because this is where the identifier taxonomy really shows its value. One global product, multiple regional identifiers, a Dyson V15 Detect cordless vacuum. The global MPN is 448842-01. That number is the same whether you buy it in Chicago or Berlin or Tokyo, but the US UPC is 88V609034521. The EU EAN is 87201V37776543. The Japan JAN is a different 13-digit number starting with 49.
JAN being Japanese article number. Same GTIN 13 structure as EAN, just a different country prefix. So the MPN stays constant, the GTIN changes per region. And the reason isn't just bureaucracy. Different regions have different packaging, different regulatory labels, sometimes different power cords or plugs. The physical trade item is slightly different, so it gets a different trade item identifier. But the engineering core, the motor, the cyclone assembly, the filtration system, that's identical, and that's what the MPN tracks.
The MPN is the global anchor. The UPC and EAN are regional aliases.
And here's the reverse case that trips people up. Sometimes one regional UPC maps to multiple part numbers because the same box is sold through different channels with different warranty terms or different included accessories. You think you're comparing two products because they have different part numbers, but the UPC is identical, and that's because the box is identical even though the warranty registration is different.
Which means, if you're comparing prices across retailers, the UPC is actually useful. It confirms you're looking at the same box. But if you're comparing specs, the MPN is what tells you whether the thing inside the box is the same.
That's the core tension of this whole topic. Marketing wants you to compare brands and stories and lifestyle photography. Identifiers let you compare physics and dimensions and actual motor wattage. But only if you know which identifier to trust and where to take it.
We've got the taxonomy mapped. We've got the geographic mess untangled. The next question is the practical one. You've got the MPN in your hand. Now, where do you actually go?
That's where the spec hunting playbook gets fun, because the answer is different depending on whether you're buying a microcontroller, a microwave, or a miter saw. But there's a hierarchy of sources that works across categories, and once you know it, you'll never read an Amazon spec table the same way again. And that manual playbook is exactly what Korn is about to walk us through.
Right, so this episode is basically the practical sibling to a question we've kicked around before. Is there a global product spec, API, for normal people? And the answer, spoiler, is no. There's no clean consumer lookup. But there is a manual playbook, and once you learn it, you stop being the person who buys the wrong thing, because a product photo looked convincing.
That's the real framing here. We're not going to theorize about what a global product database should look like. We're going to give you the actual workflow that engineers and procurement people use every day, adapted for someone who just wants to know whether a dishwasher will actually fit under their counter, or whether those noise-canceling headphones really hit the decibel reduction the marketing copy claims.
The core tension is simple. Marketing wants you to compare brands, stories, lifestyle photography, and carefully curated review quotes. Identifiers let you compare physics and dimensions and actual motor wattage, but only if you know which identifier to trust and where to take it.
Most people don't. They search the product name on Google, land on Amazon, read the spec table that was populated by a third-party seller using automated scraping tools, and think they've done their research. They haven't. They've read marketing copy formatted to look like specs.
The spec table on Amazon is the nutritional label written by the candy company.
That's uncomfortably accurate. So here's what we're going to do. We'll walk through the whole taxonomy, UPC, EAN, GTIN, MPN, ASIN, SQ, but with a specific purpose. Not because barcode history is inherently fascinating, though I'd argue it is, but because knowing which identifier to use in which context is the difference between finding a real datasheet and drowning in SEO spam.
We've already started that map. UPC is the checkout code. MPN is the engineering key. Model number is the product family. Everything else is a regional or retailer-specific alias. But the taxonomy only matters if you know what to do with it.
So the episode will move in three layers. First, we'll do the UPC origin story, 1973, the Uniform Code Council, that first pack of Wrigley's gum. Because understanding who issues the code and why tells you exactly what it can and can't do for you. Then we'll map the whole identifier family tree and the geographic mess that happens when one product ships to 50 countries. And then, and this is the payoff, we'll walk through the actual spec hunting workflow. Where to go, what sources to trust, and what fallbacks exist when the datasheet is missing entirely.
By the end, you'll have a repeatable process that works whether you're buying a laptop, a cordless drill, or a replacement water filter. The identifiers change, the sources change, but the logic is the same.
I want to emphasize something before we dive into the UPC history. This isn't academic. AI-generated product descriptions are flooding search results right now. Google's AI overviews are summarizing spec information from sources that were already wrong. The information environment for consumer products has become actively adversarial. Knowing how to bypass it entirely to go straight to the engineering source is a superpower.
The manufacturer's datasheet is the only document in this entire ecosystem that wasn't written to persuade you. It was written to inform an engineer who needs to integrate the thing into a larger system. That's why it's trustworthy.
That's why the MPN is the skeleton key. But first, let's understand the key that most people already have in their pocket, the UPC, and why it's almost never the one you actually want to use. To see why, let's go back to the very first time that UPC ever made a sound. June 26, 1974, a Wednesday morning, Mars Supermarket in Troy, Ohio. A checkout clerk named Sharon Buchanan scans a 10-pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit Gum. 67 cents. First UPC transaction in history.
67 cents for a piece of history.
That pack of gum is now in the Smithsonian. But here's what most people miss about that story. The UPC wasn't invented to help consumers compare products. It was invented because grocery checkout lines were too slow and inventory tracking was a nightmare. IBM had a team in Research Triangle Park led by George Lohr who designed the actual barcode symbology. And the Uniform Code Council, that's the predecessor to GS1 US, was formed in 1973 specifically to administer this system.
The governing body predates the first scan.
By about a year. And that governing body is crucial to understanding what a UPC actually identifies. GS1 US doesn't make products. It doesn't test products. It assigns company prefixes. A company pays an annual fee, starts at about $750 a year for small businesses, runs into the tens of thousands for global enterprises, and in return, they get a block of numbers. The first 6 to 10 digits of any UPC are that company prefix. The remaining digits, minus the last one, are the item reference that the company assigns internally. The final digit is a check digit calculated from all the previous digits.
The manufacturer assigns the item number, not GS1.
GS1 says, you are company number 0123456. The manufacturer says, and this specific product is item number 001. Put them together, add the check digit, you get a 12-digit UPC. But here's the thing. The UPC doesn't identify the product. It identifies the trade item, the specific packaged unit that gets scanned at checkout. A 12-pack of Coke cans and a 6-pack of Coke cans contain identical cans. Same liquid, same aluminum, same factory, but they have different UPCs because they're different trade items.
The UPC is tied to packaging and pricing, not to the thing itself.
And that's the first big misconception busted. If you're trying to find specs for a product, the UPC is almost always the wrong starting point. It tells you what box it came in, not what's inside.
Which brings us to the part number.
The part number is assigned by the manufacturer for internal tracking. No governing body, no annual fee, no checkout function. It exists purely so the company can manage its own inventory, supply chain, and engineering revisions. And because engineers are the audience, the part number is usually the most granular identifier available. It can distinguish between revision A and revision B of the same circuit board. It can distinguish between the US model with a NEMA plug and the EU model with a Schuko plug. It can distinguish between the version that shipped with firmware 1.2 and the version that shipped with firmware 1.3.
The model number sits above that, the consumer-facing name.
The model number is what you see in marketing. Dyson V15 Detect, ThinkPad X1 Carbon. It identifies the product family, but a single model number can have dozens of part numbers underneath it. Different colors, different regions, different bundles, different retail channels, different warranty configurations. Let's make this concrete with the Sony headphones. The model number is WH1000XM5. That's what you type into Google. The part number for the black US model is WH1000XM5/B. That's what you type into a distributor catalog. The UPC is 027-2429-23415. That's what the cashier scans.
The European version of the same headphones.
Same model number, WH1000XM5. But the part number changes. It'll have a different suffix for the EU regulatory variant. And instead of a UPC, it has an EAN, something like 454-87-36-112-345. Different identifiers, same headphones, different packaging, and power adapters in the box.
If I walk into a store and see two boxes of WH1000XM5s, they might have different part numbers and different UPCs, but the drivers inside are identical.
but the part number is what tells you for sure. And if one box is from an older production run with a known firmware issue, the part number is what distinguishes it. The model number won't. The UPC won't.
Which is why the part number is what engineers search.
Now let me give you the mental model that makes this stick. Think of it as a granularity ladder. At the top, the broadest category, you've got the model number, the product family. One step down, you've got the part number, the specific engineering artifact, down to the revision and region. Below that, you've got the GTIN layer, UPC, EAN, JN, which identifies the sellable trade item at the shelf. Then below that, you've got marketplace specific identifiers like the ASIN, which is just Amazon's catalog entry number. And at the very bottom, you've got the SQ, which is retailer-specific and tells you nothing about the product, only where it sits in a particular warehouse.
The ladder from most to least useful for spec hunting. Part number at the top, model number one rung down, GTIN below that, ASIN below that, SQ at the bottom.
The Sony example maps perfectly onto that ladder. Model number WH1000XM5, product family. Part number WH1000XM5/B, the black U.S. engineering variant. UPC 027-242923415, the checkout code for that specific box. ASIN B09Y2J Y6S9, the Amazon catalog entry. And if you went to Best Buy, they'd have their own internal SQ that has nothing to do with any of the others.
The ASIN is interesting because people treat it like a product identifier, but it's really just Amazon's internal database key.
It's marketplace specific in a way that subtly differ from a SKU. A SKU is one retailer's inventory location, and ASIN is Amazon's catalog entry, which means multiple sellers can list against the same ASIN. But the ASIN doesn't travel. You can't take an ASIN to DigiKey or Mouser and get a datasheet. You can't take it to the manufacturer's support page. It only works inside Amazon's ecosystem.
GTIN is the umbrella that covers all of these regional barcode formats.
UPC is GTIN 12. EIN is GTIN 13. JAN is GTIN 13 with a Japanese country prefix. They're structurally the same thing. The only difference is the number of digits and the geographic prefix in the 13th position. A GTIN 13 starting with 0 or 1 is US or Canada, 4 is Japan, 5 is the UK, 8 is Italy. The GTIN is the global identifier family, and UPC and EAN are just regional dialects.
The summary so far, if you want to buy the thing, scan the UPC. If you want to understand the thing, find the part number. The UPC is a checkout code masquerading as a product identifier.
It's not even trying to masquerade. We just collectively started treating it that way because barcodes are visible and part numbers are hidden in fine print on the bottom of the box. The most useful identifier in the whole system is the one you have to squint to read.
Which is almost certainly deliberate. So we've got the family tree mapped. Now here's where it gets chaotic. What happens when the same product is sold in the US, Europe, and Japan? Does the UPC follow it?
Let me give you the cleanest worked example I know. Dyson V15 Detect Cordless Vacuum. Global MPN, the one Dyson's engineers actually use, is 448842-01. That number stays the same whether you're in Des Moines, Dusseldorf, or Dotonbori. But the barcode on the box? In the US, it's UPC 88560903-4521. In the EU, it's EAN 871015377-6543. In Japan, it's JAN49025301234-56.
Same vacuum. Three different checkout codes.
The reason isn't just bureaucratic. The packaging changes. The EU box has different regulatory labels, different warranty language, sometimes a different power cord. The Japanese manual is in Japanese. Each of those variations is technically a different trade item, even though the machine inside is identical. So the MPN is the global anchor. The UPC, EAN, and JAN are regional aliases.
The reverse happens too.
Yes, and this is the more insidious case. Sometimes, a single regional UPC maps to multiple part numbers because the same box gets sold through different retail channels with different warranty terms. You buy the same vacuum at Costco and at Best Buy, same UPC on the box, but one has a 2-year warranty and the other has a 5-year warranty. The part numbers are different. The UPC is identical. If you're comparing specs and you only have the UPC, you don't know which warranty configuration you're looking at.
The general rule, MPN, is truth. UPC is context.
Now we get to the payoff. You're standing in a store, or more likely staring at a product page, and you want the real specs. What do you actually do?
Walk me through it.
Step 1, find the MPN, not the UPC. The MPN is usually on the manufacturer's product page under specifications or technical details. If it's not there, check the retailer's specs tab, though those are often truncated. The product box itself is the most reliable source if you have access to it. Look for the fine print near the barcode or the regulatory label. It'll say something like model number or part number or MFG.
Once you've got it.
Step 2, where you search depends on what you're buying. For electronics, you want distributor catalogs. DigiKey, Mouser, RS Components, Farnell, which is Newark in the US. These sites are built for engineers. They don't have marketing copy. They have datasheets, PDFs, parametric search with hundreds of filterable attributes. DigiKey alone has over 15 million components, and their parametric search is the closest thing to a consumer product spec API that exists today.
For appliances and tools.
Grainger, McMaster, Carr, Zorro. Or go straight to the manufacturer's support page. Most manufacturers have a downloads or documentation section that's completely separate from the marketing site. For consumer goods generally, avoid Amazon spec sections entirely. They're populated by third-party sellers and automated scraping. They're SEO spam hell.
I want to rank the sources. Cleanest to dirtiest.
Number 1. Manufacturer official product page or support archive. Best for current and discontinued gear. Lenovo support page, for example. You search the MPN for a ThinkPad X1 Carbon Gen 11, something like 21HM, and you don't get marketing. You get the hardware maintenance manual. Every internal dimension, every screw type, every replaceable component. Number 2. Distributor catalogs. Best for parametric comparison. Number 3. GS1 lookup at gpeer.gs1.org. It confirms the company prefix and the basic product description, but no actual specs. It's a verification tool, not a research tool. Number 4. iSecket. It's a product data aggregator that retailers use, but consumer access is limited. Number 5. The Wayback Machine. For discontinued products whose official pages are gone, it's often the only source left.
When none of those work,
then you enter the fallback playbook. First, the 3-review cross-reference. Find 3 independent reviews that measured the same spec, decibel level, wattage, actual dimensions, and average them. One reviewer might be sloppy, 3 won't lie the same way. Second, for anything with a wireless radio, look up the FCC ID. FCC.io gives you internal photos, test reports, sometimes antenna gain measurements. Third, for appliances, check the Energy Star database or the California Energy Commission database for efficiency specs. Fourth, for tools, look at replacement parts diagrams. They show exact dimensions, materials, and assembly relationships. A parts diagram is often more honest than the product page.
Because it was drawn for someone who needs to fix the thing, not someone who needs to be persuaded to buy it.
The parts diagram is the manufacturer talking to a repair technician. The product page is the manufacturer talking to your wallet. Those are completely different conversations.
Let's pull the playbook together. If I'm about to drop real money on something, what's the 4-step checklist?
Step 1. Always start with the MPN, not the UPC. The UPC is for checkout. The MPN is for research. Find it on the product box, the manufacturer's site, or the regulatory label, that little sticker with the serial number and compliance logos. It's the least marketing adjacent piece of text on the entire product. Use distributor catalogs for parametric comparison. They're built for engineers who need to filter by actual dimensions, tolerances, materials. For electronics, DigiKey's parametric search is unbeatable. For appliances and tools, Grainger or McMaster Car. These sites don't care about your lifestyle. They care about the wattage.
Step 3. The fallback.
When specs are missing, triangulate. FCC ID for anything with a wireless radio. FCC.io gives you internal photos and test reports. Energy Star or CEC database for appliance efficiency. Replacement parts diagrams for tools. They show exact dimensions because the person reading them needs to order the correct bolt. And the Wayback Machine for discontinued products whose official pages have been memory-holed.
The parts diagram trick is the one I keep coming back to. It's the spec sheet the manufacturer didn't realize they published.
And step 4, be reflexively skeptical of any spec that appears only on Amazon or a third-party retailer site. If you can't find the manufacturer's own datasheet PDF confirming it, treat it as rumor, cross-reference, or ignore.
The whole thing in 4 words. MPN first, distributor second, triangulate third, verify always.
The time investment to do all 4 steps is maybe 5 minutes. 5 minutes to defeat an entire industry of marketing copy. That victory raises the open question I keep turning over. Google is already pushing structured product data through Merchant Center. AI-generated descriptions are flooding every marketplace. Does that make the spec hunting problem better or worse?
Worse, almost certainly. The incentives haven't changed. Manufacturers still benefit from you comparing brand stories instead of wattage and decibels. AI just lets them generate more story, faster, at scale. The SEO spam spec sheet is about to become an SEO spam novel.
The structured data push from Google is promising in theory, but it depends on manufacturers actually providing accurate structured data, which they have zero incentive to do if the real specs make their product look worse than the competitors.
The spec sheet is a liability for most consumer brands. It's not an accident that it's hard to find. It's strategy.
There is one interesting thing on the horizon, though. The EU's Digital Product Passport Initiative. It's part of the Ecodesign for Sustainable Products regulation. Starting in 2027, certain product categories, batteries, textiles, electronics, will be required to carry standardized digital product data, accessible via a QR code or data carrier on the product itself.
A legally mandated spec sheet.
That's the idea. Standardized fields, machine-readable format, persistent throughout the product's lifecycle. If it actually rolls out as planned, it might be the closest thing to a global product, spec API we ever get. At least for products sold in the EU.
Which means the MPN for a vacuum sold in Berlin will eventually link to a government-required datasheet, while the same vacuum sold in Chicago still hides behind marketing copy.
Unless manufacturers decide it's cheaper to standardize globally rather than maintain 2 sets of documentation. That's the optimistic scenario. The EU regulation drags the rest of the world along with it.
The trickle-down spec sheet theory. I'd like to believe it.
We'll know in a few years. In the meantime, the playbook we laid out today still applies. MPN first, distributor second, triangulate third, verify always. 5 minutes of effort to defeat an entire industry of deliberate obfuscation.
The next time you're weighing 2 products, spend 30 seconds finding the MPN before you read a single review. It changes what you're actually comparing. You stop comparing someone's lifestyle photography and start comparing physics.
That's the whole thing, really. Marketing sells you a story. The MPN sells you the object.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this episode happen.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.